This is Australia Remembers, tape 13. The date is the 20th of November 1995, and this interview is with Jill Buick of Devon Meadows.
Well, starting back at perhaps the beginning, after a 12-month battle with the mother, I finally enlisted at the age of 19. From there I went through the Air Force training scheme, of Empire Air Training Scheme, and eventually, at the end of about a year, we were posted direct to transports. I flew originally with an American squadron on loan from the Air Force, and we did the Kokoda Trail, all the supply dropping, and when we got over into Kokoda we started picking up the wounded and bringing them back to Port Moresby, where the main hospitals were. From that we went right through to Dobbitura and that whole area. We also did the Wau battle, taking the 17th Brigade into Wau, which was quite an interesting place. The runway was on the side of a mount of a hill, and there was 1,100 feet of runway, the bottom end of which was 300 feet below the top end of the runway. And it made landing and taking off quite interesting. You had to take off downhill and land uphill. Then we let the troops out. The Japanese at that stage were about 50 metres, 50 yards it was in those days, from the end of the runway. And since it was in a valley, if the Japanese had had enough sense to put a couple of machine guns on the opposite side of the valley where we were turning to go into land, they could have got every transport that went into the place, but they never ever woke up to it. Thank heavens, for our point of view. We did a lot of carting of stuff in and wounded out. Also the artillery, we took the artillery into Wau as well, and they tried their best to frighten hell out of the Air Force by taking their guns out of the aircraft, putting them together and firing over the top of the aircraft down at the Japanese. And it's not a very, very amusing point of view. We went right through the Ley, Markham, Finchhafen, down to Milne Bay, Goodenough Island, and generally around the around New Guinea, mostly taking ammunition and food into troops, dropping them or landing them, and bringing out wounded as far as possible. The wounded were very badly knocked about in most places, and you could add to that the fact that they'd probably been carried or had to walk 2 or 3 days to get near enough to an airstrip to be carted out to hospital. It was a most unpleasant experience.
And what sort of planes were you flying in New Guinea?
Well, the American Air Force terminology for them was a C-47, which is a transport. From the RAAF point of view, it was what they happily called a Dakota, Don't ask me why, we've never ever found out. But they were commonly used both before and after the Second World War as civil airliners, but these, of course, were a military version made for to suit military operation.
And what were their strengths and weaknesses as a transport?
Well, their biggest strength was that they could carry a lot of material and had quite roomy capability or roomy space. The aircraft itself in civilian life was used at 26,200 pound all up weight. Now that is your load, your pilots, your fuel, the whole bit, and the aircraft itself. During war we were flying them at 33,000 pounds all up weight, which meant we could jam a lot more stuff into it, but it made it a little dicier than it was in civilian life.
And could you describe a typical sort of day for me?
Yeah, we were woken normally at 4 o'clock in the morning. We went and had quick breakfast. We only showered in the afternoon because we never had enough water in the morning. Then you were taken down to your aircraft, which had been loaded during the night, and start your engine, do your checks on the aircraft, and get going. You'd be going usually 10 or 15 minutes before dawn. So you had two dawns. You had dawn on the ground, but earlier you could have a dawn in the aircraft, which was quite spectacular sometimes to watch. And went on to the first landing point. You do that, get down to the bottom, down to ground. They would unload your aircraft, or alternatively, you either had to throw it out when flying somewhere wherever the troops were, and then come back, pick up another load. The worst part of it was that you went in the aircraft after the sun was well up. The inside of the aircraft would be around about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, pretty warm. And then you took off. You had to climb to about 10 or 12,000 feet, and the temperature there was about -6. And then you went down again, the temperature went up, and you had to put up with it. We didn't have oxygen in those days. We flew up to 19,000 feet without oxygen. But in Europe, if they flew above 10,000 feet, they had to be on oxygen. We never got oxygen until 1944, late 44, early 45. Quite a few heart problems amongst air crews. It was all right for people who were only doing one trip. It used to make them feel a bit peculiar, but people who were doing it all the time, they suffered for it.
So how many trips would you do in the day?
Usually about four. That's not quite, it'd be about four and a half, because the last one, the cloud would beat you. So you couldn't get through to where you were going, so you had to go back to base. The cloud itself was too dangerous to fly into. Not like the cloud down here where it you can fly through 90% of it. Up there you can fly through about none of it, unless it's under 1,000 feet.
This would be about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, would it?
About 4, as a rule, we'd finish. Go home, have a shower. That's if I'd got any water. And eat and go to bed, then was it.
What was the situation at Port Moresby like? Was the base always secure there?
Yes, the base was quite secure apart from bombing raids. We've got plenty of those. But the place had been very badly bombed. There was very, very little in the way of buildings left. Of just the huts put up by the services. The shipping was coming and going all the time down into the Moresby Harbour. One of them still sits in the Moresby Harbour, the old McDewey. They chased her all around the harbour, the Japanese, and finally bombed it, and it sank onto a reef. But most of it sits out in the air.
We were talking a minute ago about Ted Allen and his group being flown into Wales. Mm. You said you were involved in that.
Yes, our square. I was at that stage with the 374th troop carrier, what the Americans called troop carrier group. And the 374th did most of the work going into Wales. We did have a couple of other squadrons, but not any small stuff.
So were you under American command?
Yep. It was quite funny. We'd finished flying school. We never ever did what they called an OTU, or Operational Training Unit. We were just shot straight out to fly as co-pilots with the Americans, which was a permanent American squadron, the 6th Troop Carrier. So we flew with them. Learned a lot. It was very useful.
Was that ever difficult, you know, being directly under the American command?
No. I could not have flown with a better mob than I did with the old American Air Force, the Army Air Corps it was in those days. But they were all, most of the pilots were staff sergeants. Unlike later on, the Americans had all pilots were officers. But when I got through them, the CO was only a captain. And my aircraft captain was a staff sergeant. We had a couple of officers, but very few. Good bunch of blokes.
So after New Guinea, where did they send you then?
Well, back to New Guinea. I spent most of the time in New Guinea.
Right.
We were then flying with the RAAF, the 36th Squadron. That was when the aircraft were borrowed from America. We only had one C-47, which was really an Australian Air Force aircraft. A-65-1 was its number.
And so this is more Australian Air Force by this stage, is it?
Yes, they'd been borrowing aircraft. We had, a normal squadron in those days was about 12 aircraft. The 36th Squadron had 27 aircraft, most of which were borrowed or illegally obtained. They had no hesitation in making sure that we had everything we needed. So the Air Force Corps didn't give it to us, we stole it. It's the whole of the transport people just don't really know about. They saw or heard very little of them. But the poor coots who wanted to be fed and ammunition, they're the one, they remember us.
I think we lost the description of the WOW airfield a bit earlier. Would you mind repeating that?
The WOW airstrip was on the side of a hill, of a valley would be a more accurate description. It was 1,100 feet long, and the top end of the runway was 300 feet higher in altitude than the lower end of the aircraft. So when you landed, you were going uphill rapidly, running out of speed with the aid of a bit of few brakes and things. But when you were going down, you never seemed to be going fast enough that you weren't going to run out of runway before you got airborne. You did, but it never seemed like it at any stage. We also landed later on at Bilolo, which is just down the valley from where. It's an old gold area of New Guinea.
It was obviously very difficult getting supplies in to those regions.
It was. It was really two-thirds of the way the distance to Lae, but it was fairly in the middle of the mountains. So cloud was always your problem. You can run in very easily in New Guinea. You can just try to go up a valley on the cloud, and the ground runs out of, or the aircraft runs out of air before the ground stops. It just keeps going up so sharply. Quite a lot of aircraft were lost like that.
And so was it basically some sort of backup in New Guinea once the major offensives in New Guinea were over? Were you mainly keeping...
It was never over in New Guinea.
Wasn't it?
No.
I thought it was.
Well, some areas were, but if you got through to one, got one area cleaned out, there was another one just up the track a piece. So we worked through from firstly the Kokoda, basically the Kokoda Trail, but it was halfway along that before we started. WOW, Lae, Finchhafen, Madang. At the same time, we'd gone down to Milne Bay, Goodenough Island, Tadji, or Itapi, then Hollandia, and then Noumfa, Moratai, and through gradually working through the island into Borneo, Balikpapan, I've forgotten the name. Sananda was one of them. There was a whole flock of battles taking place.
So were you flying from Moresby right up to Borneo?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, we had, when I came back to 36 Squadron, which was based at Townsville, we had a detachment in Moresby. And I spent a great deal of my time with that because I was experienced with the island flying.
And how old would you be by that stage?
About 21. I never got in till I was 19. I fought with my mother over wanting to enlist, and she didn't want me to. So I joined the Air Force when I was 19, and then was 20 before I
got up.
Went on ops. Come on.
I thought that by the time they got up to Borneo, the airfields would have been closer.
Well, there were a lot of airfields between Moresby and Borneo, but you always had to get an airfield close to where the action was, so that you could get the ammunition through to the people who were doing the fighting. We never fought anyone, they just shot at us.
And what stage did you come back to Australia?
Well, I got out in 1945.
Right. Is that after the bombs or?
No, just before them. I'd been posted to a squadron based in Melbourne at that time, 37 Squadron, but that was only about 3 months, 2 or 3 months, I think, before the end of the war.
So were you discharged fairly rapidly after the end of the war?
I was never discharged. I was transferred to reserve, which wasn't my idea. I wanted to get out, but they didn't want me to get out. In other words, they didn't know that the war was finishing. So they bunged us on reserve so that they could just drag us back if they needed us.
So you could still be called back?
I could have been, yes, right up. I think I was about close on 60 when they finally let me out. The Air Force never let things go very easily. The conditions by war standards for the squadrons weren't too bad. They were only suffering bombing. They weren't getting people shooting at them all the time. And we did get fed a fair bit of the time, until they ran out of tucker, as usual. The whole of the services are pretty good at running out of food. The worst part from our point of view by a long chalk was the carting the wounded back. They were in such a dreadful mess, most of them. You never ever forget it.
There'd be a lot of disease as well, wouldn't there?
Oh, yes, there was typhoid and that sort of thing, but I think by far the greater part, and malaria was quite common, of course, but by far the worst of it were gunshot wounds. Some of them were really in a mess. The photographs you see of some of the people coming back over the Kokoda Trail, or coming from Myola back down, doesn't show you really what it was. If you saw the mess the people were at that stage, it did bother you. I don't think there's a devil of a lot more I can tell you, really. Mm.